America, we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. By honoring your career calling, you impact your family, your friends, and your community. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now, 210-599-5555.
And if you call that number right now, if you're the next two callers, you'll probably get right through because Matt and Frank are in front of you. They'll be our first two guys that we talk to. It's a beautiful Sunday morning out there, though. It's going to get hot this afternoon, but then supposed to get back into a little bit more seasonable fall weather, giving us a real good chance of rain. I haven't heard anybody officially say why, but I'm sure it's that little tropical storm that's moved offshore from the Pacific side, and I'm hopeful. Typically, that's where we get some of our best rainfalls for those storms that come across Mexico and then make it up as far as we are. But keep your fingers crossed. That's what we really need this coming week. So anyway, well, enough of that. Let's go ahead and get started with phone calls this morning. And Matt was first in line. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning. excuse me. Got a frog in my throat.
Me too. Go ahead.
I've got an asparagus bed that has been overrun with Bermuda grass.
Okay.
So I was hoping that I would just dig those out and transplant them into a new bed that I've solarized and everything, and so it's ready to go.
All right.
Is that even possible? Will I get all those Bermuda roots out of there if I try to transplant those?
Well, you'll have to do it very carefully. You'll have to really sort out and be sure that you just pull the Bermuda grass free from the asparagus roots. It'll be pretty obvious. Asparagus has a big, thick root, many times almost as big as a pencil, whereas Bermuda runners and all are going to be more the size of the piece of lead in a pencil. So that's certainly one of the most efficient ways to do it. Unfortunately, you will set back your production a little bit because you can't dig without doing some damage to the asparagus roots. But that certainly, provided your new bed is totally Bermuda free, that's the best way you'll totally clean it up. The other option would be to compost your asparagus when you cut it down. You know, I generally wait and see if it freezes. If it hasn't frozen by the end of December, then at that point I'll cut it down to about 2 inches tall. The other option would be to wait until you've done that and then put about 3 inches of compost over that, and then you'll find the Bermuda pretty easy to pull as it tries to come up through the compost. But that won't be 100%, and that'll be an ongoing issue that'll probably take you 3 months to get it under control instead of one afternoon. So the choice is yours, but it's a good plan. If you want to really totally eliminate the Bermuda, and you'll dig very carefully, separate the Bermuda very carefully, then that's going to get you off to a clean start, assuming your new bed is free of Bermuda. And like I say, I'd wait till either we have a hard freeze or until the 1st of January when you would normally be cutting your asparagus back to an inch or two tall.
Okay, that was my next question, is when would be the best time to do that?
Yeah, if it freezes, if it browns out the top on your asparagus, which effectively puts it into dormancy, do it any time after that. I've seen years when, you know, we didn't really have a freeze until end of January, 1st of February, and I'm not about to try to predict weather. That's only crazy people do that. But if it hasn't frozen back by New Year's, I would cut it back at that point. Do your digging. And the nice thing about doing it this way is you don't have to do it all at once. If you've got a 25-foot row of asparagus, you can do 5 feet at a time one day a week. And, you know, at the end of a week, it'll all be done. But you will want to, you know, shorten your picking season this spring, just as you would if you were planting new roots. I'd still go ahead and, you know, pick for a week or so, but you can't stretch it out and take, you know, everything that comes up for the next 3 months like you can on a well-established bed.
Okay, and would it be a good time to divide any of those crowns, or
How long has your bid been in?
About 3 years.
Yeah, you're not going to find that they've gotten big enough to divide. I'd leave them intact because that's going to give you bigger, more plentiful stems. If you told me 13 years, I'd tell you, yeah, you could probably do some dividing. But 3 years is a very short period of time in an asparagus crown's life.
Okay, and so my bed is, it's just a 4x8 bed.
Uh-huh.
How many asparagus plants would you put into that 4x8 bed?
Well, you don't really worry too much about crowding, and if it's only 4 feet wide, you can get to it from, you know, all from both sides, so to speak. So 4 foot wide bed, I'm probably going to put probably three rows of asparagus crowns about a foot apart. So that's going to be room for at least a dozen good plants. You say 4x6, actually, that'd probably be room for, you know, like 18 crowns, because you can put them up fairly close to the ends, fairly close to the sides. So somewhere between 18 and dozen and a half and two dozen crowns, because like I say, it doesn't hurt them to be crowded.
Okay. And then my next question, I have another 4x8 bed that I want to put some blackberries.
Mm-hmm.
And so my question is, so if I have one of the cattle panels, would I put that like in the center and then put blackberries on each side?
I would put it a little off center. I'd put it like 3 feet into the bed, and then I would plant blackberries along one side only. 8 feet? Did you say 6 feet or 8 feet?
8 feet.
8 feet. You can put about, you know, 6 to 8 blackberry plants there, and it's going to make a very thick growth. The one side, the wider side, you want to leave that alone, because your blackberries are going to put out little underground runners, or rhizomes as we call them, and put up some new plants that you'll transplant out, or, you know, put plant somewhere else, but you want to leave yourself plenty of room for them to do that. They're going to grow through that cattle panel. They're not going to really extend too far into the walkway on the other side, but it's going to make a thick growth along your cattle panel support, and planting on both sides of it would just be too much. You'd get torn up a lot trying to get in to pick the berries, and then, as you know, if you've grown blackberries before, at the end of the picking season, you're going to have two kind of classes of plants. You're going to have the plants that produce berries for you, and you're already going to have a lot of the new growth coming up from that spring. So what you want to try to do is go through and the plants that produce, you're going to cut them all the way to the ground, because that keeps things very vigorous. It reduces the few disease problems that you can have with blackberries. But you just don't want that blackberry bed to be too crowded, or it's too hard to work. So I'd plant, you know, one row of blackberries on the wide side of the bed, right up against the base of the cattle panel, and get ready for some delicious eating.
Okay. And then do you have any idea, any good strategies to keep those stink bugs out of my blackberries?
Be watchful, and if you see any sign of them, spinosad is the is the product to use. Try not to do it while you have active blooms on your blackberries, because spinosad can be hard on bees. But other than that, it's I wear garden gloves and the old thumb and forefinger, you know, is my method of controlling a lot of things. But stink bugs are generally not too much of a problem. If you can be very selective, most of the worst stink bugs start out as a juvenile that's red in color with black legs, and they tend to run around in a big bunch. And if you can catch them at that stage before they're spread out all over the berries, then just one good squirt with your hand sprayer of spinosad should be killing them 15 at a time that way, and they will not be numerous enough to become a problem for you.
Okay. Well, I appreciate it. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, it's a pleasure. That's what I'm here for. And if you can find Roseboro, that is still my favorite blackberry. The old standard is one called Brazos. It's a very good producer. It has a smaller berry, though. And if anything, it's even thornier. And Roseboro has been a little hard to find the past couple of years, but it's still the biggest, juiciest, most productive blackberry I can find. So if you can find that one, that's the one I would be my top suggestion.
Okay. And you don't have any at Shades of Green right now, do you?
Not yet. Hopefully by okay. February we will. You probably are not going to find blackberries until, you know, early into 2024. If you find you need any more asparagus, that'll probably show up about the 1st of January. Typically, we start seeing blackberries about the 1st of February.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
I appreciate it, Matt. Great questions. Thank you, sir.
Thank
Let's
you.
Go ahead and talk to Frank, and before we take our next break, good morning, Frank.
Good morning, Bob.
Morning, sir.
One's about potted plants and the other one's okay. about trees. I'll start first. In September, we spoke to you about recommended trees and such out here in Spring Branch.
Uh-huh.
And so we did. We got two. We got a Mexican sycamore, and we got a chicopin oak, and they're in 45-gallon containers. They've already been planted by... You know, a person with a stronger back than myself.
Wait, yeah, I'm glad you didn't use the word professional. There are a few of them out there, but hard to find people that'll dig holes these days and deal with something that probably weighed 300 pounds. But long as they got that root flare up at the surface, should be off to a good start.
They did. And the trees are 4 and 5 years of age, roughly.
Uh-huh.
I guess the question that we had is, they had to use a machine, obviously, to bring them from the truck, and then they put mm-hmm. it in the ground. But they also had to jackhammer a little bit out here, you know. How does that rock affect these trees?
The rock will not affect the trees at all. The thing that I hope they did, is after the hole was dug, you always want to fill it with water and be sure that that water drains out. As I always tell people, water doesn't hurt anything, but if the soil stays too wet, the water drives the oxygen out of the soil, and that's what kills tree roots. And I see people occasionally basically jackhammer a bathtub into a layer of rock, and the water has nowhere to go and never drains out. If that happens, you've either got to, or whoever's doing the hole digging, either has to break through that rock and be sure that the water can drain out, or if you hit rock in too close to the surface, what you do is either create a raised bed or a berm, just a mound up, because rocky soil, I mean, gosh, look at the gorgeous live oaks we have in the hill country, probably right around you too, that are growing in very rocky soil. But if you dig a hole in such a fashion that it can't drain, that unfortunately will ultimately be the kiss of death for the trees.
Okay, so I believe all that is true, what you stated, because they did. Water has drained away, and since I've watered them, the water does drain away.
Yeah, you might want to, out of a 30-gallon, you said they were in 30-gallon buckets?
45.
45-gallon buckets, and that bucket's going to be about 18 inches high. It might be interesting to move outside the root ball, you know, a few inches, and just dig yourself a little, you know, post hole down in there that you can observe so that you can, or, I mean, I would even consider going as far as drilling a couple of holes in a piece of plastic pipe and putting down there somewhere close to the root ball, and then you can stick a long pipe cleaner, you can stick a bamboo stake or something down there, and just be sure that there's never water standing in the bottom of that hole. That is the only thing that really could go wrong as far as digging in rock. It's just, like I say, jackhammering a hole in it that doesn't drain. But hopefully they did that right, and it'll be not a concern for you.
Okay, so then it's funny, the way you stated that, it was leads into my follow-up question, which is the drip line watering. When we water, do we need to water outside that berm any that these guys made?
A little bit, because obviously you want the roots to spread out. You don't want the roots to stay in that hole. And roots are going to grow where they have oxygen, nutrient, and moisture. So you need to work and be sure that that's the situation, ultimately several feet out away from the trunk of the tree. So your main watering will be, you know, the size of the root ball that's there. And some of that water is naturally going to spread a little further. But when you're checking to see if something needs water, always feel right at the base of the tree, because, you know, that's where it's going to dry out fastest through the process of transpiration. But when you water, water a little outside that, just to give that, keep that soil as a place that those roots would want to grow, if that makes sense.
It does, because I was considering that, but I wasn't sure. Fertilizing frequency?
If you want to encourage maximum growth, use a liquid fertilizer maybe once a month, a Hester-Grow plant or their liquid fish blend or something like that. If you want to use a dry organic fertilizer, do it once every 3 months or so.
Okay, we did Hester-Grow last week.
Yeah, do it about every three weeks or 3 to 4 weeks, and that'll get things off to the best start and year round, because those roots stay active even when the top of the tree is dormant in the winter.
And watering as we go into the winter, every other day?
Nah, stick your finger down in the soil. When it's dry and an inch deep, it's time to water again. But every day, if you can, and the temperature is above freezing, pick up that hose and just spray up and down the trunk, especially on the Mexican sycamore. It's going to dry out faster. It's going to require more water than the oak. But at that stage, while the bark is still smooth, both of those trees are going to absorb lots of moisture directly through the bark, and that's what's going to make for a really healthy, fast-growing tree.
Yeah, the Mexican sycamores, you know, it's fall and starting to drop a few leaves. So
yeah.
And staking in a tree of 3 or 4 to 5 years of age, is that necessary?
No, and it's a bad idea. If you're going to have to visualize this. If we were on TV, it'd be easy to show on a blackboard or something. But if those trees, either one of them, are in a spot where you get a lot of wind, and you're worried about the tree, you know, rocking back and forth or blowing over, by far the best way to anchor the tree to the ground, and you know, close your eyes and visualize this, but take two pieces of pipe that are maybe 4 feet long and lay maybe 3 or 4 inches out from the trunk, but lay them flat on the ground on top of the root ball, and then anchor the two ends of the pipe. You can do it with a U-shaped rebar, you can do it with a big rock or whatever else, but anchor both ends of that pipe. That will keep the root ball from rocking back and forth, and that's the best way to secure a tree. You have to, you know, watch it when you're mowing around it, because obviously you don't want to hit an iron pipe with a with a lawnmower or whatever. But that is the way that when you've planted a tree the size that you have planted, that is the absolute best way to anchor it in position so it doesn't rock around and break the new roots that are forming. Did you get that mental picture? Did it come through clearly?
I did. They're on the south side of the back porch area out of the house, and so they're
sure.
They're basically where the old cedars were, and so well away from the house. But they're blocked from the north wind by the house. But
outstanding.
I've had a question about a watermelon plant. She's going to ask you.
Okay.
Hi,
watermelons.
Bob.
Good morning.
Yeah, it's a watermelon pilea, or also called an aluminum plant.
Oh, pilea, yeah, aluminum plant, pilea cattieri, if I remember right. But yeah, it's a great, great little house plant.
Yes, and we actually got it from y'all.
Very good.
It started not doing very well. I had transplanted it because it was in its little grow pot, and it was drying out like almost every other day, and it's in the house. And it sits in a window. It's not touching the window because I read that wasn't good. But it sits on the floor, and it was doing real well. And then I transplanted it, starting not doing so well. So I've cut it all back. All the leaves were falling off. I've cut it back. It does have some new growth. And then I read to try to increase humidity, put it on a bed of like...
Don't worry about going to that much trouble. Main thing with the with all the pileas, and there are some of them upright like that one, there are others that are trailing, but they want really bright light. They want to sit right in a south window or a west window. Indoors, I don't think you would ever have to worry about giving it too much light. And you want to water it super thoroughly when you water it. When it's dry on the surface, it's time to water again. What you're describing is typically what they do if they're not getting as much light as they would like. So, and I hope you didn't put it in a real big pot. Never go to a pot that's more than an inch wider than the pot that it was in, because it won't dry out evenly. But aluminum plant is... And don't confuse it. There's a plant called watermelon peperomia, but I've never heard the water term watermelon used in conjunction with this plant. But it should come back out. It should do very well. But be sure that it's getting the light it needs. Be sure it's watered thoroughly when it's watered, and then allowed to dry properly. Little has to grow or something like that every 3 or 4 weeks, and it should come back out and be prettier than ever for you.
Okay. Sounds good. Thank you very much.
You guys have a great Sunday. Appreciate the call. Thank you so much. All right. Looks like I get to talk about another of my favorite people, and that's Rhonda and all of her staff out at Rhonda's Nature's Way. Just one of the neatest places around, a family truly dedicated to your good health and getting there naturally. I've known Rhonda for a lot of years, followed what she's done, and let me tell you, she's been my source. And I take a couple of supplements. I take some things to support my immune system. That's think why I had so few problems and everybody else was coming down with COVID and continues to. But Rhonda provides things to support your body, whether it's your immune system, whether it helps you get proper sleep. If you've got digestive issues, there are natural things to do. And just about everybody can use a good supplement every now and then. And what Rhonda and her staff offer, so much better than anything you're going to find in the grocery store or a chain pharmacy. Plus, best of all, they have the knowledge to help you figure out what's going to keep your body working best. Like I say, I've been a customer and friend at Rhonda's for a lot of years now, and I have no hesitation sending you, as I've sent so many people. One of our employees says that, he suffered from chronic pain, joints and things for years. She got him on a simple supplement, and the pain simply came very close to vanishing totally. If you're trying to lose a little weight, she has some good suggestions, some great things that really taste good but aren't loaded up with sugars and carbohydrates. If you've never had reflexology, schedule a reflexology session sometime. It's amazing. But most of all, just get by and see Rhonda's Nature Way. They're closed on Sundays, closed every Sunday, and major holidays. But other than that, she's open, looks forward to seeing you out there in the shopping center at the corner of I-10 and Callahan, kind of across the parking lot from Sprouts. Remember that name, Rhonda's Nature's Way.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, let's get back to gardening and straight back to the phone lines. It's going to be Diane and Chicken Joe and Bonnie and Paul. Diane is first in line. Good morning, Diane.
Good morning, Bob. How are you doing today?
I'm off to a good start. I was just telling my engineer, not quite as much fun as sitting outside down at the herb market yesterday, but it's a beautiful morning out there.
Yeah, I hear you. Okay, I have two questions.
Uh-huh.
First, what is it called when a seed won't germinate unless it's planted with another plant? Like it has to have a friend.
I really can't think of any seeds that would apply to. There are other plants there are a number of plants that cannot grow and thrive unless they have a mycorrhizal fungus association, orchids being one of them, and long story I won't bore you with behind that. But, you're taking me way back to botany. That's not even horticulture. It's probably commensalism or something like that. I believe is the word. But yeah, it's not a matter of germination. It's a matter of continuing to grow and thrive. And because your mycorrhizae are not so much associated with the seed as they are with the hypocotyl, which is what you call the first little root thing that comes down in the case of dicots, which probably the great majority of plants are, but I believe it's commensalism or something related to, close to that.
Okay, well, the reason I ask is because I tried growing Bush Morning Glory from seed. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you recall, I put out a whole flat of 4-inch pots with seeds and maybe 2 germinated. I mm-hmm. did cutting and they all grew. So
yeah.
I had those 4-inch pots full of dirt, and I'm like, oh, got to use the dirt somewhere. And so as I transplanted plants from one pot to another, from a smaller pot to a bigger pot, I would use that dirt.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, those seeds would germinate once they had mm-hmm. a friend.
Right.
And so everywhere, and they had been sitting dormant for months, the seeds
uh-huh.
in the dirt, doing nothing.
Okay. Well, like I say, it's most likely based around a mycorrhizal association, probably ectomycorrhizae rather than endomycorrhizae, but that would be the principal thing that would account for it. Now, recognize that we know from Elaine Ingham's work that plants are covered above and below ground, usually several layers thick with beneficial bacteria, along with the mycorrhizae that associate themselves with the roots. So you can look up the genus of Morning Glory, Ipomaea or something like that. You might look that up in a good reference, not a normal gardening book, but a little more scientific reference, and see if they mention any necessary mycorrhizal association or any particular thing that's out there that, will help them develop a root system and grow. But some sort of mycorrhizae would be my first guess. Now, if you wanted to, you could get a little package of mycorrhizal fungi. There is a company actually up in the Burney area. David Steinbrenner has a company that produces a quality blend of both endo and ecto mycorrhizae. But just as an interesting thing, I don't know if you have a good microscope or not, but it'd be fun to dissect away a little bit of the root system and look at it under a really good stereoscope or even under a more powerful microscope and see if you find any mycorrhizal association with those Morning Glory roots. That would be what would occur first to me. And the mycorrhizae, when they are put under stress, most of them will form a resting state. I don't know if it's a true spore or exactly what the nature of the resting state is, but it can remain in the soil for years and years. So I think that is what would seem most likely to me.
Okay. Now, I don't have the microscope, but do you sell the mycorrhizal fungi that you were talking about?
We do. Yeah.
Oh.
Uh-huh.
Put some of that in the dirt to see if that would elicit germination?
It would be a very interesting thing to do. It would be an interesting thing to do. The other thing that you could do is, if you, and who knows how much is still in there, because who knows exactly where it was stored. But if you're buying any of the Nature's Creation potting soils or compost, they add mycorrhizae to that soil. Legally I probably can't say it, but I just happen to know that chances are very high that if you're using any of the dry, if you're using the dry growing green fertilizer from Medina, chances are you're going to find some mycorrhizae there. Stuart can't put it on the bag unless he pays the government a bunch of money for testing and things like that, but he can add a lot of things. He just can't say that they're in there. But I have a strange suspicion that you might find some mycorrhizae if you're using growing green, in the soil around those things as well. It'd be great to get a bag of mycorrhizae, but that's $20 you might spend on some, rather spend on something else and when it's probably already in some of the soils and some of the fertilizers that you use.
Yes, I happen to have a couple of bags of that stuff. Okay, my next question. I think this is the time to be harvesting sweet potatoes, but since it's been so warm, would it be wise to wait till it cools off a little bit more?
Makes no difference. The sweet potato is not a perennial plant, and a sweet potato doesn't truly ripen. It simply gets bigger and bigger. So what I tend to do is take my index finger and probe down in the ground, and when the sweet potatoes have gotten to a size that, you know, I want to use, then I'll harvest them at that point, whether it's early in the season or late in the season. I mean, if you're out to win a contest, I've seen pictures of sweet potatoes that weighed 45 pounds. Take quite an oven to cook that. But it's not going to ripen. It's not going to change as the weather changes. It's simply going to get bigger.
Okay, awesome. Thank you so much, Bob. You're the
always
best.
A pleasure. Always a pleasure to hear your voice. And you get out and have a great Sunday, and we'll talk again soon. And keep up the good work with Paws in Prisons. That's a really cute, cute young dog that you sent a picture of, and we're considering it. Somebody we know, including me, probably wants a golden this time around, but you guys are doing such great things over there in Seguin. Keep up the good work.
Thanks, Bob. You have a great day.
Thank you. Goodbye. And if you don't know, she's associated with a group called Paws in Prison that part of the rehabilitation of people who've had the misfortune of having to be incarcerated, part of the rehabilitation, great program they've had where they take abandoned or homeless dogs and socialize them, raise them, get them healthy, and then look for healthy homes, happy homes for them. So if you're looking for a dog, consider the Paws in Prison program. They're really, really great. I get to talk to you for a moment about Medina. Isn't that a nice coincidence? Because Medina makes so many good products. Their fertilizers, of course, the liquid fertilizer products and their dry fertilizer products are outstanding and, you know, always done with natural things. The Growin' Green Original is actually certified organic, and it cost them a lot of money to get that certification, but that means it's legal to use if you want to sell your produce as organically grown at the farmer's market or whatever. Medina makes other products that simply support the life in the soil. That's how they started out with their soil activator and later improved that to what they call Medina Plus. They also, they package dry humates and liquid humate products. They package the best orange oil in the business and so many different things. You want to see the complete list? There are a lot of things they package for big agriculture and a lot of things to support your septic tank, among other things. But go to MedinaAg.com to see all their products and visit a good nursery or garden center that recognizes quality. That's where you'll find things from Medina Agriculture.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, let's get quickly back to gardening, and looks like Chicken Joe's up next. Good morning, Joe.
Hey, good morning, Bob.
Good to see you in the nursery yesterday.
Yeah. I want to tell you, yesterday at your nursery, it looked more beautiful than any nursery, including Shades of Green, before.
Well, you're very kind. We take pride in making it a place where people feel comfortable and want to come whether they need anything or not.
That's right. Well, like you say, you know, you got to pay to get into the botanical garden, but you got to pay to get out of Texas.
But it's a personal choice. What's going on in your world today?
Well, hey, you mentioned the herb market a few minutes ago. Is that going on today?
That was yesterday. Yeah.
A day late and a dollar short.
Okay. It's always, if you want to put it on your calendar, it's always the third Saturday in October.
Okay.
I think it's been that way the 32 years they've had it, but that's the best way to keep up with it. And it was a nice event. I, of course, can't stay all day. I have to come back and go to work. So, but it was sure getting off to a good start when I left yesterday morning. But you know, you blink twice, it'll be next October, and hopefully you'll be here then.
Okay, great.
In San Antonio, I mean. I know you'll be around somewhere, but hopefully you'll be in San Antonio then. Me too.
Yeah, I was about to make a bad joke about that. I've got a couple of questions this morning. I got an interesting situation in my front yard. I have two identical red oaks. They're they're big ones, and one of them was a zombie tree. But my favorite arborist in the world helped me bring it back, and it's looking really nice. But my other tree, which didn't have any problems during the big freeze, it has. I swear it must have a million acorns on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is that the case in all over town, or is it just my tree?
It's a case wherever the trees are stressed, and most trees are stressed from drought. Occasionally, you may find an irrigation system that's good enough, or maybe a young enough tree that it's not oversized. But drought is. Or let's just say any kind of stress is what makes plants really bloom and consequently make seed very well. It's you stress a bougainvillea a little bit, it's going to have a lot more flowers on it. You stress a pecan tree up to a point, it's going to set a lot more nuts. It's going to take plenty of moisture to have them fill out. But a lot of the trees seed production, in the case of oaks, that we just call them the seeds acorns, but for the most part, stress, environmental stress, is what determines when a tree sometimes puts on a bumper crop. Something in there says, hey, we're not too good off, we might die, so let's make as much seed as we can.
Okay, all right, that's what I thought, but I just was concerned.
Yeah.
And the other question, I need a little primer on taking care of a staghorn fern. I got a staghorn at green Shades of Green yesterday, and it's in a pot. I never had a staghorn before in a pot. The first staghorn I bought 40 years ago was stapled to a little bit of peat moss on a board, and it ended up being 4 feet across before I even think I had bought chicken paradise. But, and I'm not going to have to take care of it very long, but I bought it for a Christmas present, and so I got to take care of it for a few months until a couple of months, I guess, until Christmas. So,
well,
I never watered a staghorn before.
Lots of light and lots of water. It's kind of like many orchids. In nature, staghorn ferns grow not necessarily clinging to the side of a tree like an epiphytic orchid, but they grow up in a crotch in a tree or something like that, where they are close to being what we would call true epiphytes. And also, just like orchids, if they're maintained on a plaque or in a wire hanging basket or something like that, where they can make multiple small plants around them, that's how they take very hard, regular care. You probably have to water daily. You just it's a lot more trouble to take care of a staghorn or an orchid on a plaque than it is in a pot. And fortunately, they adapt just fine to pot culture. Now, in time, if you can put them maybe in a wire basket or something like that, they'll get even bigger. They'll make even more little plants growing in there. But they're in a pot for convenience. And you will find that they are much easier to maintain as far as frequency of water and things like that. But beyond that, the three secrets are light, humidity, and regular watering, a little bit of fertilizer now and then, of course, too. But you won't have to water as often in a pot as you did that one that was on a plaque. But that's really the only difference. And ultimately, it will want to grow, and I think the best way to probably do it is in a big wire hanging basket with a core liner or something like that. But eventually, it's going to outgrow the basket, and when that happens, you give it away because it's too much problem to take it apart and repot it. Believe me, I've done it for friends before, but that's the only difference in what you've got there, Joe.
Well, I will tell you real quick, when that staghorn got to be about 30 years old, I actually gave up on getting bigger and bigger wire containers, and I just drilled holes through it and put cables through it.
Oh, yeah.
It worked just. But, okay, so I actually water the soil.
Yeah, Yeah, water the soil, and other than that, everything's going to be the same. I don't have time now to go into the interesting botany of staghorns or one of the ferns where the sterile fronds and the fertile fronds are totally different, but next time you buy the nursery, we'll talk about that if you're interested in it. But as far as culture, just be sure you never let it get dry. Use good liquid fertilizer, and the care is just less intensive in a pot.
Okay, super. Well, as usual, you've been very clear, and so I'll let you get on to the next caller.
Well, unfortunately, I'd need to take one quick break here, and then it'll be time to move on to that next caller, Bonnie and Paul. So hang on just a second while I talk about Southwest Metal Roofing Systems. And again, people say, why do you talk about a roofing company? I say, well, peace of mind. How much time does the average person with a shingle roof spend worrying about their roof? If you listen to the ads, you're probably worried all the time because they're always telling you either the heat hurts your roof or the cold hurts your roof or the hail hurts your roof. There's always some reason they need to come out and inspect it and perhaps replace it. Now, think how much more peace of mind if you have a Southwest Metal Roofing Systems roof on your home or office. Then you can be like me or like our staff here at the nursery. We don't worry about our roofs. They've stood up to hail. They've stood up to high wind. They've taken a couple of lightning strikes, and they're just as good as the day they were installed. Southwest Metal Roofing Systems, their motto is do it once and do it for life. It's the last roof you'll ever put on your home. They even do new construction. If you're building a new home, simply tell your builder that you want Southwest Metal Roofing Systems to put the roof on. That's what we did with our groundwater district office up in Burney. They simply put on the best roof in the industry. There are lots of choices of colors and styles. Get the best warranty in the industry, and it's a roof that's so energy efficient it'll save you money every month on your utility bill, and probably your insurance company will give you a discount on your homeowner's insurance. How many reasons do you need to pick up the phone and call 210-822-6868? 210-822-6868 for Southwest Metal Roofing Systems.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, back to gardening. First in line is Bonnie. Good morning, Bonnie.
Good morning. Good morning, but it's not Bonnie, it's Bernie.
Oh, Bernie. Okay, well, very good. I probably read it wrong or else I can't read my own writing. How can I help you today?
Well, I've got a question. I have a fig tree and my neighbor has a fig tree and I get no figs and she has figs. But she does absolutely nothing. The whole summer she didn't give it a drop of water.
Mm-hmm.
What am I doing wrong?
Figs require, you know, good, bright sunlight. The better soil they have, the more figs they will produce. And quite frankly, there are probably at least 15 different varieties of figs that will grow in this area. Typically, the ones that are bigger figs require more water. A lot of the little small figs will produce whether they get water or not. But if you want to have good figs, lots of sun, plenty of water, and heavy mulch around the trees, and it's probably just that either she's got a little bit more soil where hers is planted, or it's probably, or it could be easily could be a different variety of fig than you have, and some of them are definitely much more productive than others.
So it's nothing I can do.
Well, you can get a cutting, or you can do what's called air layering. I'll let you look that up on the internet and see exactly how you do that. But you can go get a little piece of hers and plant it, and then threaten yours with a chainsaw and say, look, you know, you got some competition. If you don't produce, you're out of here. But I suspect it's just so long as yours is getting, you know, lots of sun. That's the other thing. You can take even a very productive fig, put it in the shade, and you won't get nearly as much fruit. But I suspect it's just a different variety is why hers is producing while yours is reluctant.
Oh, okay. Well, I thought you'd give me a magic bullet.
Well, I wish I could, but You know, sometimes you just, and like I say, you don't have to go buy one. The figs are very, very easy. Look up air layering. You slice a little bark off one limb, wrap some moist sphagnum moss around it, wrap it up in aluminum foil. You need to do it while the weather's still pretty warm. You know, within a few weeks, you'll have lots of roots growing out into that moss, and then at that point, you just cut it off. You've got a pre-rooted cutting, and you pot it up. If her fig has a limb that's very low to the ground and you want to do it even more easily, bend up a coat hanger, pin that fig limb to the ground, put a couple of shovelfuls of soil on top of it. By next spring, it will be fully rooted. You can cut it off, dig it up, and have your own. And if she's a good neighbor, I'm sure she wouldn't mind a bit. So why don't you try to get a piece of her started, and then y'all can both have good figs.
Okay, that's a good one. I'll do that one. Okay. Thank you.
You're certainly welcome. Sorry about getting the name wrong, and we'll move along to Paul. I think we got that one right, didn't we, Paul? Good morning.
Sir. Hey, good morning, Bob. Suggestions on where to get bulk compost and living mulch?
Probably the many places have more than one type of compost. I'd have to say perhaps the majority of the compost is made in this area is by New Earth Technologies, and you can buy directly from New Earth, but they do, because the city pays them to, they also produce a biosolids compost as well. Excuse me, which I do not recommend for yards. Okay, on agricultural land, but I want a manure-based compost, and you go directly to New Earth, the company that has the most locations around. It used to be called Stone and Soil Depot. Now it's called Site, S-I-T-E, Site 1. And there are a couple of smaller compost companies around, one over toward Castroville, that typically have very good compost. But the main thing I want you to be sure of is that you're getting manure compost as opposed to biosolids compost.
Correct, and that's what I want to stay away from that as well. So so Site 1 is basically marketing for New Earth products.
That's now you'll have to ask them. That's what, as long as Chef Knight owned the company, that was where he got the majority of his. Now, one of his locations, and one of the Site 1 locations, is the original one out on 1604 that was Fertile Garden Supply. And for a while, they were making some of their own, but I doubt that Site 1 is doing that. They're a big company based in Georgia, and I think they are more, kind of like reselling. I mean, we buy most of our plants. We only grow a few of them ourselves, and they buy most of their compost rather than make it themselves. But they do have a reputation, and they're out to be honest with you and give you good quality. I'm not choosing them over, and I need to list some of the other companies because there are some other good ones around. But they are the biggest, and they have the most locations around. So probably they're going to be the closest to you, and consequently would probably charge you the least amount to deliver to you if that's the option you choose to take.
Yeah. Location, location, location.
That's it.
One more question, Bob. So my key lime flower set, and they got to be about almost BB size.
Yeah, and then they dropped off. Paul, let me get Greg to put you back on hold. We'll talk about this a little bit more because I've got to go to news here on KTSA Radio.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right. Well, let's get back to gardening calls. Paul, I'm sorry. I have to get out right on the second for that national news stuff. So sorry to interrupt you, but we were talking about your key lime. You said it set fruit. They got up to pea size, and then we had to listen to something less important. So let's continue that conversation.
So maybe not pea size, but like a small BB, and then they just stop. And they never drop, Bob. They're still on right now, but they're, like you say, just not doing anything. So the heat?
The heat is a very likely cause. It also happens when you don't get much pollination because, the purpose of making fruit is for a plant to reproduce, and it has a little built-in system that knows whether or not it's gotten pollinated enough to form some seeds inside. Normally, if the cause is poor pollination, then they will, like I say, they turn yellow and drop off. In this case, it probably was the heat. They should resume growth. As you've heard me say, I'm sure, many times, a plant has what's called a compensation point, and that's how much energy it takes to stay alive. When the compensation point gets too high, as it was most of this summer, there's simply nothing left over to grow and bloom and produce fruit. So now that we are back to more favorable weather, fertilized water, and they're probably not going to make real big key limes, but the reason we grow most of them is just for the juice they produce, and even a small key lime is going to probably be quite juicy. And the fact that there is some fruit on there, it really should not interfere. Key limes, of course, are one of those things that can bloom any time year round. They're not like Persian limes and most other citrus that does all of its blooming in February or so and then produces everything in the fall. Key limes can bloom any time. They can set new fruit at any time. So it's not unusual on a good, healthy tree in a little bit more reasonable condition to have small fruit, medium-sized fruit, and large fruit all at the same time. So I wouldn't cut it back. I wouldn't... there's not anything in particular I would do other than be sure you're watering and fertilizing. And hopefully at least a number of those limes will go ahead and resume their development.
Okay, great. The plant looks good. It's just, like I said, it just put to grow. So, all right, I'll stick to it and appreciate the help today, Bob.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for being patient. And next caller is Yolanda. Good morning, Yolanda.
Yes, good morning, Bob. How are you today?
I'm good. It's a beautiful morning out there. It's going to get warm before the day's over, but I'm sitting here looking out at a beautiful garden and enjoying a pleasant breeze coming through the window. So hope your morning is off to as good a start as mine is.
Oh, yes. I'm an early bird, so I've been doing all kinds of stuff today. I do want to ask you a question, though. I have some wildflower seeds, mm-hmm. and last year I put them out, spread them out, like in October, but uh-huh. this year, because it's been so hot, mm-hmm. I just don't know if it's still a good time to put them out this October.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Most varieties of wildflowers aren't really going to germinate and grow until spring. But bluebonnets in particular have to be planted in the fall because they have like two life stages. And they have to make this little low rosette of leaves several months before they put up that big spike with the beautiful flower. So those, if you're going to get any flowers from them next spring, they need to be in the ground sometime in the next couple of weeks. Others, you might get away with waiting till spring to plant them, but most of them are cold hardy. Most of them will germinate and you have a chance to get a good root system established so that when the weather warms up in the spring, they can jump up and flower and the flowers will last for you. So I would recommend planting the seed rather than storing it. Now, hopefully we're going to get the rain. Hopefully it's going to, give us the weather that will give us a beautiful spring as far as wildflowers go. The nice thing about most of our Texas wildflowers is that they are so hardy, the seed can sit there for several years if the weather isn't right for them to, sprout and grow and bloom. But if you don't plant them, they're not going to bloom for sure. So I'd go ahead and plant them. And, of course, you don't have to bury the seed or anything. You simply rake the area, throw the seed mm-hmm. out, and as long as it makes good contact with the soil, has a good chance mm-hmm. of growing and giving you flowers next spring.
Right, and that's what I did last year. And I was thinking, because it's going to rain here, hopefully, one day this week, so I'm going to go out there and kind of rake and throw them out there, and hopefully they'll get some rain. And so that would save me a...
That's an excellent idea. I'm telling people, get out and plant your winter rye if you want to get that out. If you're thinking of fertilizing or putting out compost, there's just a lot of things a person could be doing today and tomorrow getting ready for hopefully what's going to be a good rain event this next week.
Yes, I'm so excited. Well, that's exactly what I'm going to do. I'm going to get out there, rake, then spread them and pray it rains.
And
if not, I'll have to water.
You have fun doing it, Yolanda. I appreciate the call this morning.
Thank you for your information, Bob. You have a good day.
Thank you very much. Goodbye. All right, next in line is Martha. Then it'll be Mark. Good morning, Martha.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Hi, Bob. I wanted to ask, how can I take good care of my begonia? I got one, and it's beautiful, and it was fine for a little while, but now the leaves are turning yellow. And so I don't know if I'm doing something wrong or what's going on.
Can you tell me what kind of begonia it is? They're Rieger begonias or angel wing begonias. There are our common garden variety begonias that we call multifloras. Does yours have big leaves or small leaves?
Medium.
And what color are the flowers?
Pink.
And how tall is the plant?
How tall? Well, it's not very tall. The limbs go out and they go straight at, parallel, not horizontal. It's not tall, but it's in a big pot.
Okay. Are the leaves rounded or are they more shaped like a proverbial angel wing would be?
Yeah, that's how they're shaped, like a little angel wing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, then that is an upright begonia that typically will live for several years. If they're outside, they want to be in very bright shade or morning sun. They don't want the hot afternoon sun, but they need lots of light. They'll have to come in when its temperature is going to drop below, say, 35 degrees, but they're going to be much happier outside than inside up till that point. Be sure that when you water very thoroughly, then let the soil get good and dry on the surface. If they're dropping leaves, it usually indicates they're either not getting enough light or they've gotten a little too dry at some point. So I would, water them, fertilize them good with little Garrett Juice or Super Thrive or something like that. And like I say, if they're outside, have them in morning sun or really bright shade. When you do have to bring them inside, and we probably will get at least some cold this winter, but keep them in the sunniest window you can if you don't have a greenhouse.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I have a back patio that doesn't get, that is covered, so I won't get the snow or freezing rain that, comes, but it's open.
Yep.
But I kind of wrap them up with something.
Well, and hopefully we're not going to have to do that too much this winter, but be sure they're out right toward the edge of the patio where they get plenty of light, because that kind of begonia, if they're going to grow well, and they do bloom some, they're more grown for their leaves, but they do have attractive flowers periodically, but they need lots and lots of light, everything short of just that blazing afternoon sun, if they're going to grow and perform well for you.
Okay, so you think I'm probably getting it get too dry between waterings, and that's why the leaves are turning yellow?
I think that's the main reason, but it also may not be getting quite as much light as it wants. And remember, there's no such thing as too much water, but there is too often. So when you water your begonia, really flood it thoroughly, then let it get dry about an inch deep and water it very thoroughly once again.
Okay.
I see, and you're a good gardener, so this probably isn't you, but I know a lot of people that water them too often, but they don't put enough water on them when they do, and they're actually dropping leaves from lack of water because the roots are all the way down in the bottom of the pot, and not everybody realizes that, you got to really soak the entire pot to keep a begonia happy. So a little more light, a little bit more, I'll say a little more care in watering, because you're always going to not have to water as often in the winter when it's cooler and darker and the days are shorter. But watch your watering real carefully. Do give them some fertilizer, and they should put on plenty of new leaves for you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Yolanda. Thank you so very much. Okay, quick break here, and I'm sorry, that was Martha. A real quick break here, and then we'll be back with more phone calls. I get to talk about Fanick Nursery and Garden Center, and that's always a pleasure. I've known the Fanick family for, most of my nursery career, and just good people, big nursery, lots of experience, and kind of the special people that love plants, and that's why they're in the business. Sure, it's how they make their living, but you can tell the difference in box store and a really true nursery. And Fanix is a true nursery. It's been around for close to 90 years, right in the same location over on Home Green Street. And right now, gosh, I talked to somebody at the herb market yesterday that said that they were just running over with the new fruit trees that they've gotten in, mostly in containers, which means you're going to get about a year's head start on getting them into your orchard. Fanix is also well supplied with all the plants that qualify for the SAWS Water Saver Landscape Rebate Program. They've got the fall and winter vegetables that you're looking for. They've got garlic and shallots by the pound, and they've got lots of things for inside and all the organic fertilizers, supplements, natural pre-emergents, just about anything you're looking for your landscape or garden. You're going to find it over at Fanix. They're open every day to serve you right over on Home Green Road, where they've been for all their close to 90 years, and they're there to help you. If you want to check out for any special events or anything like that, you can always go to Fanix, F-A-N-I-C-K, FanixNursery.com.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster, News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, let's get back to gardening and straight back to the phone. Go to Debbie. All right, I believe Debbie will be next then. Good morning, Debbie.
Good morning. I still hear music. I don't know if you're there.
We just kind of backed that off real slowly. I'm right here and looking forward to talking to you.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you for getting up early and helping those of us that get up early.
Well, it's my pleasure. I get up early anyway, but this is a fun thing to do on Saturday and Sunday mornings. So how's everything in your world?
Wonderful. It'd be better if we had a pretty rainy day.
And hopefully we're going to see that next week, but I'm afraid I'm the eternal optimist. I hope it works out that way.
From our mouth to God's ears. So we're going to put in some raised beds for vegetables. What do you suggest we put them in? I mean, you can buy metal ones, you can buy box ones. People make them out of foam kind of things. How do you suggest we start that?
Make them big. I don't recommend railroad ties anymore. Either they're so old they're going to rot out on you, or they've still got so much creosote in them you wouldn't want them. Metal tends to rust out even when it's galvanized, and the zinc in there can be hard on your plant. So if rock is still a good thing to make a raised bed and relatively attractive, cinder blocks are an excellent thing to make a raised bed and not very attractive. There is a type, I don't recommend treated wood either, because they've taken the arsenic out, but they still have some pretty nasty stuff in there. There is a type of wood that is excellent for raised beds, but the bad thing is there's no place where you can buy small quantities of it. It's called Eco, E-C-O, Eco Vantage, and it is a treated wood, but it's not a chemical treatment. It's a heat treatment that bakes the carbohydrates out of it so the termites don't go after it, and it is so thoroughly dried it actually seals the surface of the wood so it doesn't rot. They've had it in ground contact in East Texas for 30 years, pilings in swamps for 30 years. If you ever want to see what it looks like, come by Shades of Green, because we built a couple of greenhouses and a couple of overhead structures. We've used a fair amount of it in construction around here, and it's absolutely outstanding. But I'd go to EcoVantageWood.com and see what they suggest. They do have an outlet in San Antonio, but it's not a place you can go buy one or two boards at a time. If you've got a big building project going on, or if you're a professional carpenter or whatever, or if you're like us, you buy $5,000 worth of wood at a time, they're set up to deal with you. But EcoVantage wood is an excellent material to use to make a raised bed. The other thing that you can buy, not quite as pretty, but it is very permanent, is the, I call it fake wood or artificial wood. This material is called Trex, T-R-E-X. It's actually a plastic material with wood fibers embedded in it. There's a lot of it sold to build build decks and things out of. Lowe's is one of the big suppliers of it here. And like I say, unless you've got a real big project going on, and if you want to use something that you cut like wood, that you screw like wood, that you drill like wood, the Trex type products are excellent to make a raised bed out of. So there are your choices.
Oh, okay. And I know what Trex is because we built a deck with some of that. Okay, mm-hmm. Well, that's a good option. And what should we be planting probably 3 or 4 weeks from now when we get that built?
You can plant lettuce, chard, kale, spinach, broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, lettuce, radishes, carrots, beets, turnips. We'll have to watch the weather. The one thing about planting from seed is it takes those little plants a little while to harden off, to really get to where they can take the cold weather. But everything I mentioned will typically go down to the teens without damage. But if it's a plant that just came out of a warm greenhouse, or if it's a little seed that just sprouted, they're going to need a little time to harden off, and you'll have to protect them at first. But in a typical San Antonio winter, those are things that that we plant pretty much throughout the winter months. If there's anything in particular, I'll happily tell you more about it. But the list of different things you can plant is actually longer in the fall than it is in the spring. And, you know, we can back up and I can add bok choy. There's just a lot of, but I guess to sum it up, I'd say root vegetables, leafy greens, and what we call the col, C-O-L-E, the col family, which is broccoli and its relatives. Those are all things we grow in our winter gardens here. Come about January, we'll be planting the edible pod peas for production later in the spring too.
So we don't plant any tomato right now. None of them.
Oh no, not unless you've got a greenhouse. Now, other things that we'll be planting pretty shortly when they're available are onions, and of course, right now you can plant garlic, you can plant shallots. There's things like that, but the true onion plants, they'll be available in the nursery come early November, hopefully.
Oh, that sounds good. Well, you were just talking about fruit trees or during your break or just before it. So I have a lemon, a lime, and it makes a teeny little orange. Somebody gave it to me, and you actually can even eat the peel, and I don't know what it's called. But
it's called a kumquat. It's called a kumquat, K-U-M-Q-U-A-T. Not to be confused with a loquat, this is a kumquat.
Well, it's finally, after years, full of blooms, and we had lots of bees this year for the first time, but I put them in a bigger pot. I put a lot of dirt on them.
Yeah.
When do I want to put them in the ground? They've been potted about a year in big pots.
Well, certainly not right now, because we don't know what the winter's going to be. The kumquats are the most hardy of the things that you've mentioned, and they'll actually go down to about 20 degrees without damage. But lemons and limes and many of the oranges, now the so-called the tangerines, they are more cold hardy, and the kumquats are a little more cold hardy. But your lemon and lime, they're probably going to stay in a pot for most of their life, or else you're going to have a lot of trouble protecting them the years that we get a really cold winter.
Oh, that makes sense. I just thought they needed to go in the ground at some point. No.
And if you were buying new ones, I would tell you to look for citrus that is grafted onto a special rootstock called Flying Dragon, which keeps the trees dwarfed, just like the M9 rootstock does in apple trees. It keeps the trees dwarfed so that they'll be better in pots, but still allows them to make bigger fruit. But you pay a little more money for that, and they're a little bit harder to find. But most all your citrus, now things like satsumas, they're eventually going to outgrow a pot, and they're cold and hardy enough to put in the ground. But many people have had citrus in the same pot for 20 or 30 years, so there's no rush to get them in the ground.
Well, awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. Have a good
Well,
day.
As always, it's a pleasure talking to you, and you do the same. Okay, Greg, are we headed for Mondo next? I believe that would be our. I would be that. That's our next caller. Good morning, Mondo. Okay, go to Mark next, and then Mondo and Brad. All right, Mark, it's your turn. Good morning.
Okay. All right, yes, sir. I had a couple questions. So I'm trying to grow carrots this year. What are your thoughts on what I should do and how to prepare everything?
Well, carrots are grown strictly from seed. You don't ever buy them as little small plants. Stick with the shorter varieties. There's one called Nantes. There's one called Danvers Half Long. There's some little finger carrots. But our big, long, super big, giant carrots like you see at the grocery store, they just don't do as well here. So stick with the smaller carrot. You're going to plant them from seed. The seed is relatively tiny. And what you're going to get when they start coming up, it looks kind of like a mohawk haircut. And the most important thing you'll do is go through and thin them out. There's no way that seed is so small, there's no way you'll be able to spread it out far enough as you plant it. So once it's come up, once they put on their first true leaves that actually look like carrot foliage, you're going to go through and thin them out to where the individual plants are about 2 inches apart. Beyond that, it's just bright sunlight, you know, water, maybe a little bit of liquid plant food periodically. Depending on the variety, it normally takes about 60 days for them to make a big carrot. They don't really mature, but to get them up to a size that, you know, that you want to eat them raw or cooked, it'll typically take about somewhere 50 to 70 days for them to produce. But the most important things are lots of light, and be sure you thin them out to where the plants are about 2 inches apart. Otherwise, you'll have all top and no carrot.
Okay. And then I have some volunteer potato plants. Should I pull those out, or is it, can I let them grow? Will I get potatoes out of those?
Well, the problem with potatoes is the tops freeze, and typically the white potatoes at least don't keep well in the soil. So if it's not a space that you need for something else, water them, fertilize them, let them grow. Maybe this will be one of the years that we don't get a hard freeze until February. You're probably not going to get big baking potatoes, but if they have a couple of months to grow before it gets real cold, you could easily get some new potatoes from it. So you've got nothing to lose if it decides to freeze early. Well, then you'll know to start earlier next time. A lot of people grow potatoes in the fall, but it's just a gamble as to when it's going to get cold enough to freeze the plants. But like I say, if you don't need that space for broccoli or cauliflower or something that you would otherwise be planting, leave them, let them grow, and when that first hard freeze is forecast, dig and enjoy what you have.
Okay, that sounds good. I appreciate it. I got to let you go. My mom's rushing me to get tacos. I got to go.
You've got your priorities in order, Mark. Get out and do it. Okay. All right, we better get a break in here, and looks like I get to talk to you about Wild Birds Unlimited. You know, the people I talk about are people I know, and Wild Birds Unlimited, I've known them for years, and let me tell you, it's a wonderful place to visit. Kyle and his staff do an outstanding job. They are so knowledgeable. They can answer, well, they've never let me down. They've had an answer to every question I've had about birding or nature in general. They have wonderful seed blends. I mean, birds need different seed at different times of the year. They know all about that. They have suet cake enriched with many different things. It's really popular with the birds this time of year. They have the hot bird seed that the squirrels tend to leave alone too. And they've got the best feeders and the best ways to feed the birds. They've got plenty of ways to offer water as well, including the traditional bird baths. But beyond the birds, still a great nature store. You'll find a lot of different useful things out there. I'm sure they have mason beehives, have bird houses, and they've got a great selection of gifts as well. Every Wild Birds Unlimited shops independently for their gift merchandise. Our store out there here in San Antonio, it's out at the shopping center right there at the corner of Northwest Military and Huebner Road, right there in Northwest San Antonio. They've got some of the best gift merchandise you will ever find, and it changes all the time. You just need to go see them. It's a fun place to visit, super nice people to visit with, and you're always welcome at Wild Birds Unlimited. You're also welcome to give a call anytime if you have a question. 479-BIRD, 210-479-BIRD. That's the number for Wild Birds Unlimited.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right. I've actually got a couple of open phone lines. I've been getting a busy signal. Dial quickly. You know the number, 210-599-5555. Mondo and Brad are my next two callers. Good morning, Mondo.
Good morning. My son bought a little plant at HEB, the catnip, and it started to die. And I asked him, or I told him, let's replant it. And we replanted it. Any special suggestions for what? I don't know what kind of plant it is. I don't know what it's used for. But it's just that it makes the cats kind of go crazy.
Yeah, and it's kitty drugs, we call it. And it's actually not bad for them. The cats will eat it as well as want to rub on it. It improves appetite. Anyway, it's a neat little plant. It's not a house plant. It's something that you guys will need to be growing out on a porch or a patio. It can stay out right down real close to freezing, and then you may want to bring it inside. Don't put it in too big a pot. It was probably in about a 3 or 4 inch pot when you got it. Bigger than a 6 inch pot, and just lots and lots of sun. Have him water it really thoroughly whenever it's dry on the surface, and that'll just depend on how sunny it is and how warm it is. But do you have cats? Do you have a kitty cat or two?
Just an inside cat, yes.
Okay, and it's fine to bring it in and let the cat nibble on it a little bit, but if you I'm laughing because of the problems we have here at the nursery periodically where our cats want to get up in the flats of catnip and either lie down and wallow or they want to eat everything down to the pot. So bring it in and let your kitty enjoy a taste of it every now and then. And when it gets big enough that you can harvest a few leaves and dry them, you can make your own homemade catnip toys. There's a lot of entertainment and absolutely nothing negative about giving your kitty cats good organic catnip. And since you're growing it yourself, I know you'll grow it organically. But lots of sun and don't ever let it get dry. Those are the two things that will help it grow well. Other than that, treat it just like you would any other herb. Grow it like you would parsley or oregano or peppermint or anything like that. And and you and your cat will have some fun with it.
Any particular food to give it to make it grow better, stronger? Or
I'm very fond of liquid fertilizers for plants like that, and my favorite are still the ones from Medina. They make one called Has to Grow Plant. They make another one called Liquid Fish Blend, and those are my favorites. I'm trying to remember, Fox Farms produces some okay liquid fertilizers, but easy to find, and ones that I've used for years are the Liquid Medina fertilizer products. And they'll be good for any other house plants you have or anything else you get that youngster to growing. It's a great age to get started in the gardening hobby.
Thank you very much. Have a great weekend.
You do the same, and I appreciate the call. Thank you. I think we have time to take Brad before we take our last break of the hour. Good morning, Brad.
Good morning. I've got an oleander issue that I need your opinion on.
Okay.
And this is, I have a barn dominium down in Rockport, Texas. I planted
a
dozen oleanders. They're the dwarf kind, I guess, that only grow about 3 or 4 foot tall.
Yes, sir.
They were in three-gallon pots when I planted them. I put the weed guard cloth down around them, and I put about 2 inches of pea gravel. And they just did phenomenal, man. They put on hundreds of flowers every year. And they were planted in April of 2021 after we had the really big freeze.
Right.
Okay. So right before Christmas 2022, we had a really hard freeze down there.
Mm-hmm.
And it literally killed them to the ground. I waited till about March or early of April, and they were dead to the ground. I went and talked to Gill's Nursery about them, and they said, you just cut them up at the ground, and they should come back. So I took a chainsaw, and I just went and cut them right off at the ground. They took off, but within 2 weeks, I had sprouts coming out, and they were growing. They were just doing just like they said they would do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, during the course of the summer, I have some that are already about 18 inches tall. There's 12 of them. The about half of them started growing these, what I'll call little pods.
Mm-hmm.
The new growth was coming out in these pods, probably about an inch in diameter, that had little undersized leaves coming out of them. And I took a cutting. I took it over to Gill's, and they said, well, these plants have a virus. And that's what's causing these little pods to pop up where the new growth would be coming out. And they suggested that, well, you can try trimming them back, but you need to sterilize your cutting tool so that it doesn't, you don't spread the virus, so to speak.
Uh-huh.
But I just wanted to get your opinion on, and they also said you may want to consider just pulling them out and replanting, which, you know, these are not inexpensive plants. You know,
sure, sure.
So,
well, it's unusual.
And what I could do.
Yeah, it's unusual. I don't think I've ever seen virus on oleanders, and I'm not real sure that's what it is. Viruses usually express themselves in unusual patterns in the leaves, and it sounds to me more like an insect gall of some sort. Now, I've known James and Sally Gill for a long time, and I'm sad that they've decided to close their nurseries, I understand. But if it is a virus, again, sterilizing your cutting tools is a good idea, because that's how it's spread, both by insects and by pruning. It's spread on your pruning shears and things like that. And even if you have a virus, if you'll treat with hydrogen peroxide, I've seen plants that, and of course the extension service will tell you, oh, there's nothing you can do. You got to rip them out and replace them. But I've seen virus pretty much totally suppressed or even totally cured. So get yourself some, grocery store hydrogen peroxide just to be on the safe side. Dilute it 2 parts water to 1 part peroxide. And spray those plants' foliage with it. Do it 3 or 4 times a week or 2 apart. And I think you will find that they will start putting on good, healthy foliage. Now, the one thing that I wish that you had done differently is to leave the weed block behind, because weed block tends to just totally destroy the soil underneath it. I use weed block occasionally if I want to kill everything in a edge of my garden where I want to make my garden bigger. When I pull it up after 4 or 6 months, the soil underneath it is absolutely horrible, but I can bring it back to life with compost and things like that. But your oleander's root systems, I can promise you, are really suffering oxygen deprivation down underneath the weed block. So, and most of the time, the weed block doesn't really stop the weeds. It may stop what's underneath, but not going to what's going to come in from above. So if it were my bed, I would rake the pea gravel back, get rid of the weed block, and then spread the pea gravel back over the surface, and I think you'll have much healthier plants that will be much more resistant to all kinds of problems, whether it is a canker, which is probably bacterial, or, like I say, I can't tell you how many oleanders I've worked with in my life, and I've yet to see virus on them. So I suspect it was more a canker, which can either be caused by bacteria or can actually be caused by an insect. But in either case, if you will improve the health of the plants, they will outgrow it, whether they're dwarf or, you know, standard oleanders, either one. So I sure wouldn't panic at this point, and I wouldn't be out there ripping them up. But I would get rid of that weed block. I would fertilize. I would water. I would spray with hydrogen peroxide just to be on the safe side. And I'm pretty certain you're going to go back to the kind of hedge you were hoping for when you first planted those plants.
Should I cut those pods off before I spray the peroxide?
It doesn't really matter. Again, I really doubt that it's a virus, but the plants will look a lot nicer. So I would if they were mine, and then I would just wipe my pruning shears off with alcohol or something like that when I move from one plant to the next. If you've got 10 of these cankers on one plant, obviously you're not worried about transferring something from one cut to another. So you only sterilize when you go from one plant to the next. But I might get a second opinion, because it sure sounds more like a canker than it does to a virus to me. And good health will naturally suppress the cankers.
By the way, on the weed guard, I left about 1 foot around the plant. I didn't put the leaf guard down. I left it and just have gravel there.
Yeah.
So if I were just to, because this bed's 50, 60 foot long.
Uh-huh. Well,
if I just cut it back and just have gravel maybe 18 inches around the plant, would that help?
How big do you want your oleanders to have a root system? Do you want to have them 18 inches wide, or do you want the root system to be 10 feet wide?
So you need to take it all out then.
Anywhere you want to have good, healthy roots underneath it, you need to take it out. I hate to tell you that, but it really It stunts plants, to say the very best. And many times I've seen a lot of plants, especially when you get into wet weather in heavier soils. Now, down where you are, you've probably got sandier soil that drains a little bit better. But I've seen plants in more heavier clay soils that simply die from the results of having the weed block around them. So it was a good thing to leave it a foot around, but it'd be a whole lot better to have it 6 feet back away from them.
Okay, and last question. I didn't get a single flower this year.
Mm-hmm.
After I cut them back, is that normal?
No. No, the dwarf oleanders should bloom almost constantly. Your bigger ones, they can be a little bit more seasonal in blooming, and I don't know whether you have carnival. Do you happen to know which variety you have on your dwarf?
I don't know. I didn't keep track of it.
Yeah, you should, and they're not grafted. They're growing back from their original root system. So if they're getting good sun, good fertilizer, have a good healthy root system, you should have had flowers all summer long. So we'll just hope that next year's a better year for them. But I wish we could grow more of them up here. They're, as you found, not as cold hardy as the big plants, but you're in a great place. That's one of the most colorful things you can put out, and typically one of the most trouble-free plants. Now, the problem, oleanders do get a disease called bacterial leaf scorch, which can kill plants, but that's not what you're describing, and with good culture, you won't have a problem with that.
Okay. All righty. Well, I'll give it a try and see what happens.
You report back to me.
I will.
Get out and catch a big trout or two for me when you have a chance.
if the wind would stop blowing, and I'd be doing it.
Well, best of luck with that as well, and hopefully we'll all get some good rain this next week. You get out and have a great day. Thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.
It's my pleasure. Thank you. All right, Greg, let's get our last break done. I don't have a live here. We'll be back with some more phone calls.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, back to gardening. It's going to be Frank and Joyce and Pat and Megan. Frank is first in line. Good morning, Frank. You with us, Frank? Good morning. Just dropped off. Well, then in that case, I guess it's Joyce's lucky day to get on so quickly. Good morning, Joyce.
Good morning, Bob. I found a couple of things yesterday's show that I want to ask you.
Well, it's always good to hear your voice. How can I help?
Well, the orange Ola maple that Dirt Doctor talks about, and you said they're in the trade, but you didn't say whether, I guess Shades of Green will get them at some point. Is it just a question of calling every week and asking, or what?
Well, it's just that's probably the best thing. We will get our maples normally. We get some in November. We get some again in February. And I'm going to have to talk to Wendy to see what the availability of them is right now. But I'll tell Maxwell to make a note of it, and if he can remember to, he'll call you. He'll call you when they come in. But it would be best to check back if they're available. I know we get quite a few of them because we do have a lot of requests. We've got some other beautiful ones out there, but orange ola is just one that has been a little bit harder to find, maybe because it's gotten so popular.
Do they come in different sizes usually? I mean, different size containers, or is it just
different
ones?
Usually they go from about 2 gallon size pots up to much larger, but usually they get down to a manageable size, like a 2 gallon. Rarely do we see them in 1 gallon containers, but 2 gallons, 3 gallons, 5 gallons, and then on up for folks that want to spend a lot of money and need a big plant today.
Yeah, I always look for the smallest one. Anyway, the other question is, in years past, you used to, on the back porch, get the little tiny, I guess they were treated, but anyway, the little tiny 2-inch cyclamens, and they are so adorable to put a couple in a pot. Is that something you get every year or try to?
Those come out of California. Our bigger cyclamen come out of Denver. In fact, we got the first few of those last week. We'll probably have more. The little minis come out of California. I haven't seen them on the availability yet, but no, we love those. those and am pretty much assured that there are going to be plenty of them available this year.
Okay, well, that's good. Well, I can check on that. And the other thing is, when they talked about fig trees, I have a green Istia and a little Miss Figgy, but neither one is seemingly a heavy bear. And, of course, I know I don't have enough sun. So that
and that's a big thing, yeah.
But what would you suggest out of all the fig trees when you were talking this morning about big ones, little ones that will do that? And I live about a mile from Rhonda's where you go, so that's the area. If you don't consider size or type or anything other than the one that would bear the most in this area, which one would be your choice?
Alma, A-L-M-A, like sold in Spanish. But Alma is one of the best figs. It's what we call a closed-in fig, so you never have it forms a little drop of rosin on the fig, so you don't have a problem with that little fruit weevil getting down inside of it. But Alma would probably be my number one choice for the hardiest, most problem-resistant fig out there. It does get pretty big, but that's what pruning shears were made for.
Yeah, well, and I don't care about the eye or anything. I just want something that bears because I can put up with any of the rest of it. I like
well,
figs.
The problem with so many figs is that open end, there is something called a fruit weevil that gets down in there, and it turns your fruit sour before it really gets ready to eat. And now many people, good organic growers, don't have a problem with the fruit weevils, but there are a few plants, and Alma's probably the most commonly available one, that have the unique quality that as the fig forms, it forms a drop of rosin that seals up that little hole on the bottom end of it so that the weevils can't get in. So again, you're a good gardener, you probably don't have to worry about fruit weevils, but it just pretty much guarantees that they will never become a problem to you. Plus, it's a tasty fig, a very productive fig, but you may have to get somebody to do a little trimming for you to be sure you get enough light for them.
Okay, well, I can do that. And the last thing is, the next time you're at Rhonda's, the Sprouts that's across the parking lot there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you were talking about baby bok choy. It's
right.
Not all the time, but a lot of the time in their organic section, they have baby bok choy available. And so when you're there, you might want to pop in and see if they do the cute little 6-inch plants that little plant is a nice salad.
It's my good friends, Shu and John, you are the ones that turned me on to baby bok choy years ago. I'm glad to know where they're available, Joyce. And I thank you for the call, and you sound good. I hope you have a wonderful Sunday, and I'll look forward to our next visit. Okay, thank you so much. We're going to need to take a break here for the news, so let me take just the 30 seconds left and remind you of a couple upcoming events. State Violet, African Violet Society, or African Violet Show up in Kerrville next weekend at the End of the Hills. Nature Fest, the big festival the Green Space Alliance just puts on, that comes up the 4th of November down at Mission County Park. And if you want to have a good dinner and dance among some vintage aircraft, consider the Hangar Dance. Go to hangardance.org and you learn all about that. That's the 11th of November. Right now it's news time here on KTSA Radio, San Antonio, Texas.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
And if you hurry, you might get the one open line left. We're going to talk to Pat and Megan and Ann, and then maybe to you. So dial quickly. You just heard the number, 599-5555. Let's get back to these calls, and Pat is first in line. Good morning, Pat.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a follow-on question to the lady that was calling about raised vegetable garden beds.
Yes, absolutely.
What about cedar, like 4-inch by 4-inch cedar? Is that appropriate to use?
Well, if you, that's a great question. If you were talking about the cedar that comes out of the hill country, if you have access to cedar logs out there, that would be ideal. If you go to a lumber yard and buy cedar, you're not getting juniper, which is what, you know, they've been making fence posts the last 100 years up in the hill country. What you buy at the lumber yard is western red cedar, and it will rot out almost as fast as pine does. So, no, I do not recommend what the lumber yard will sell you for cedar, but if you're a creative person, you can go out to one of the post yards, as we call them, and sell fence posts, and you can build a very substantial raised bed out of that, and it would be a good thing.
Wow.
Does that make
okay.
sense?
Oh, yes, it does. So the 4-inch, if it's advertised as 4-inch by 4-inch, that would be what you're
saying. Yeah, you're looking at something that's going to rot out in about 3 years for you. If it's in contact with soil, and obviously if it's going to be part of a raised bed garden, it's going to be in contact with soil. If it's raised up above the ground, it'll still rot, but it'll take a few years longer. But you put that cedar in contact with the ground, and come by the nursery sometime. I can show you some mistakes that we've made over the years, and you can see what happens to it. But no, that's not what you want to build your raised bed out of.
Okay, the idea was for them to put some sort of a fabric on the sides of the cedar so that it wouldn't be in contact.
Well, the problem is that fabric's going to hold moisture against the wood, and it's going to rot even faster.
Okay, good. All right.
I'm glad you called, too, for you made mistakes that I've made over the years. So good luck with it. Call me anytime I can help. It's always a pleasure.
One more question, if I...
Okay, yeah, go right ahead.
Oh, yes, it's about cedar again, but this is about a plant called Cryptomeria that is a golden dragon Cryptomeria. They call it a Japanese cedar. Can we grow that here in San Francisco?
Can you grow it? Can you grow it, or can you grow it well? They're a good little ornamental plant. I don't think I've ever seen one live for more than about 3 or 4 years. People get them, use them as little miniature Christmas trees and things like that. So it's something that you can grow, but it's not something that you can expect a really long life from.
Even in a pot? This one is like 2 to 3 feet tall and 3 to 4 wide. So we're talking about the same thing.
Well, if you can keep the temperatures 20 degrees or above and the temperatures 95 degrees or below, then yeah, good luck.
Okay.
It's just that if you want to move to San Diego or somewhere like that, yeah, it'll be a beautiful, beautiful plant for you. But unfortunately, the extremes of South Texas weather generally shorten its life substantially.
Okay, perfect. Thank you so very much.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you for the call. Next in line is Megan. Good morning, Megan.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. How about yourself today?
I'm doing well. I have a question. I live out in the country, and I have acreage that I don't. It's cut for hay and stuff like that. So I don't want to put a fence. I don't need a fence. So I want to put just a border of plants. And I really like ornamental grasses, but I know there's some pros and cons. What's your recommendation? I like the pink muley because I like that color, and I like the purple one I've seen. But anyway, I want something I don't have to mess with too much, or that doesn't. I don't care about the seeds blowing everywhere.
Sure,
we have a lot
sure.
of land, and it just blows away.
So, which direction is your beautiful acreage? Do you ever see axis deer?
I'm sorry, what?
Do you ever see axis deer as opposed to whitetails?
No, I live in Post.
Okay, then, yeah, you'd be just fine, and there are lots of different ornamental grasses. The reason I ask about axis deer, whitetails are browsers. They don't tend to eat grass. They eat sprouts. They eat, you know, some new seedlings of oats and things like that. Axis deer, on the other hand, are hay eaters. They're grass eaters, and they'll tear up your ornamental grasses. But if all you're dealing with is whitetails, and you don't have goats or sheep or things like that, your ornamental grass will be just fine, and there are lots of choices. Some of the different muley grasses, bamboo muley is another really pretty one. The Oh, that's what I'm trying to say. Your pink-flowered one, the ruby crystals and winter gem and some of those are a little bit shorter, but they're beautiful. You can create a beautiful bed of ornamental grasses. Be sure that you understand the size, because some of them are going to get to be up, 4 or 5 feet tall. Others, like your ruby crystals, are going to stay very dwarf. So be sure you put the small ones on the side that you're going to be looking at most and the taller ones behind. But you're in a perfect place. And if you can just give a little supplemental water when we get into a really dry spell, they should be a very, very trouble-free plant for you. Most of them will freeze back in the winter months, and they will be most attractive if you'll get in and trim them back just before the new growth begins. But insects, no. Diseases, no. They're going to be pretty tough and resilient for you.
Okay. And I picked up one of your gardening calendar things last time I was in, and it talks about spraying liquid seaweed. Do I do that every 2 weeks? Do I do that till the leaves fall off? Done it once.
What kind of plants?
My trees mainly, and shrubs like.
Yeah. I was going to say your ornamental grasses. They'll be happy with it, but it's not really necessary. If you're fighting spider mites, as you would be on tomato plants, or you might be on, some of the privets and things like that, spraying every 2 weeks is good. If you're just looking to maintain good health, every 6 weeks year-round, whether the plants still have leaves on them or not, it's a real good means to give them a lot of micronutrients. If it's something like pyracantha or something that does occasionally have more insect problems, spraying every 3 weeks or so through the growing season would be very important.
Oh, okay. I was looking at it to beef things up before, to winterize things.
Oh, yeah. Cold hardiness, you need to start at least 6 weeks before it gets really cold. And it's not as critical. You're not going to get as much benefit from it once the leaves are off things. Remember that even though we can't see them, the stems, the leaves, the roots of our plants are covered many layers deep with microbial life, which helps maintain the health of the plant. So it's a good thing to do year-round.
Oh, okay. Even after we've had a freeze.
Not as critical then, it's kind of like you don't take vitamins even if you feel, you take vitamins whether you feel really good and healthy or not, because you want to stay feeling real good and healthy. And your plants are the same way. They'll benefit from it any time, but it's very important when they're in active growth.
Okay. And I do have a large dead area that I just don't water because I don't care if there's grass there or not. It's outside my yard. Mm-hmm. But it is, after the two summers, it is dead. Usually when we get rain, the Bermuda will go in there, and it just didn't this year ever come back. If I want to plant something just for the health of the soil, not because I'm looking for something green over the winter, do I do something over the winter, or do I just wait until spring? Something that'll help loosen up and rejuvenate the soil.
Well, cover crops, especially legumes like vetch and clovers and things like that, will very definitely help to loosen the soil. Of course, then you're kind of counting on our getting rain and having it continue, which I hope will be the case. But if your land's really flat, it's a good idea. If your land has any slope to it and erosion is likely to be a problem, then it's pretty much essential, because as you well know, that soil can go down to your neighbors pretty quickly when we get a really hard rain.
Yeah.
So to maintain the health of the soil, to get things to grow well in the spring. You can throw out some, can't grow coastal from seed, obviously, but if you wanted to throw some common Bermuda back there or something just to hold the soil, if you wanted to have a wildflower patch out there, all those things would be good reasons to increase the vitality and health of the soil. So, it's good to plant a cover crop if you have the time and the energy. If you have access, as many country folks do, to manure from animals that haven't been eating picloram treated hay, just a manure compost over the top of it will probably do more to improve the soil than any one thing that you could do.
Okay. And I forgot, is there an online place I can look up drought tolerant and xeriscape plants that you would recommend?
Check out Howard Garrett's website at dirtdoctor.com. Unfortunately, most of what you see on the internet is going to be from a different part of the country, and you know, Texas is its own country.
And, so what we would recommend for the Dallas area generally works down here.
It correct? Generally works very well down here.
Okay. Well, I will do that. Well, thank you very much.
Always a pleasure. Thank you for the call this morning. Bye. Greg, let's run our recorded commercials and get back for some more phone calls.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening and back to the phone lines. It's going to be Hank and Ann and Scott and Terry. Hank is first in line. Good morning, Hank.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, sir. Yeah.
Plumbagos. That's the only thing that's made it in Bull Verde with no problems out in this drought.
And yes, sir.
Is now a good time to plant them?
It just kind of depends on what you think the winter is going to do. Plumbago, once it's established, even in a cold winter, and gosh, even in the 2021 winter, when it got down in single digits at my house, my plumbago came back very well, but it had been in the ground for several years. So the problem with planting it now is if we get early cold before it gets well established, you know, it could suffer. If we end up, as a lot of people are saying, with a milder winter, yeah, you'll make yourself look really good planting it now, but most winters you don't have to do anything except mulch it. If you plant it now and we get a real cold forecast, you might have to cover it. So it's up to you. If you're planning to, you know, go south for the winter or something like that, no, wait and plant it in the spring. If you're going to be home where you could cover it if we do get really cold weather coming, then you're fine to plant it right now. So you tell me the weather, I'll tell you whether it's a good idea or not.
Okay. I got another question on a maple tree I had in the ground. It's been in the ground 10 or 15 years. Hadn't grown much, but it's starting to bush out now. Well, through this heat this year, it turned brown.
Yep.
I wonder if it's sunburned. I mean, the little limbs aren't crisp and breaking off.
Yep. It'll almost certainly come back. Yeah, most all of the really pretty maples, the big tooths are the only things that really didn't have any problems this summer, and some of them did. But we saw a lot of leaf scorch. We saw, you know, a lot of leaves, even in the shade, that just burned from the heat. But the maples that I have looked at, including quite a number that we have here at the nursery, they're going to come back just fine. At this point, I would not be concerned.
Yeah, we got it years ago up there at the Apple store in Medina. And
yeah.
It never grows much. It comes back green every year, but it acts like it wanted to start taking off. And it's got little fuzzy moss-looking stuff. It and the red buds have got this stuff. I don't know if that's what they call scale, this fuzzy moss stuff all over
no.
the box.
No, that's called a lichen, L-I-C-H-E-N. Totally harmless to the tree. It's an interesting little symbiotic plant relationship thing, but that's a normal thing to have growing on the bark of the trees. It's not parasitic. It's not taking anything away from the tree, and you absolutely do not need to worry about it.
Okay, but if I just didn't want to see it anymore, would neem oil make it go away?
No, it's a plant, not an insect. You could spray it, I guess, with a little orange oil and vinegar. You could probably spray it. You might even spray it. Hydrogen peroxide might kill it, but it's going to come back. But it's just used in the bark as a place to grow. Other than not being especially attractive, it has absolutely no threat to your plants, and they grow on rocks and, you know, dead limbs and fence posts and everything else. So nothing to worry about, but if you don't like it, I'd first of all start with a little hydrogen peroxide. It's probably what I'd spray it with. If that doesn't work, I'd give it a light spraying with vinegar.
Okay. Well, thanks. Thanks for answering your phone today.
Well, we answer it every day, and especially here on KTSA on Saturday and Sunday morning. So you get out and have a great day, and I know we'll talk again. And I believe Ann is next in line. Good morning, Ann.
Good morning.
Good morning. I can barely hear you. You're where now?
I live in New Braunfels.
Oh, in Comfort. Yes,
I take
certainly.
I took it off the speaker.
There, that's a lot better.
New Braunfels.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I took it off the speaker. early in the spring, I went to the Headwaters, if you're familiar with it, in New Braunfels, and they had a big plant sale, and they gave me a little cowpen daisy. And I planted it in a big pot. Well, the little cowpen daisy is now 4 to 5 feet tall. And it's gone crazy all summer. The deer leave it alone. I don't know what to do with it now. My husband even made a little trellis, you know, and I can have it tied to the trellis. So I don't know what to do. It's still getting little blossoms on. It's got stems sticking out all over the side. Should I cut it down? Help.
Let it. It's probably going to freeze this winter. Just let it go. Cut it back when it freezes. And I hope you like it, because I know a lot of ranchers that think it's the worst weed that grows in their pasture. So it's, you know, but it's a pretty plant. And if you're not concerned about it, if you're not concerned about it shading out your hay crop or whatever else, I don't find it objectionable. But I hope you like it, because once you've got it, you've got it. You'll never be rid of it. But
a big pot.
Yeah, but it's just thrown seed everywhere. You're going to find it. I may have to talk to that's a really great thing they're doing at the Headwaters there. It's a great organization, I might not have suggested cowpen daisies. More enemies than friends, but just let it grow and bloom and enjoy it. But if you tend to find that you have more of it than you want, in the future, as the flowers fade, cut them off so they don't continue to make seed, because it will produce a very thick stand of cowpen daisies for you.
Oh, because I even cut a bunch of seeds off and I got them planted in little pots on my windowsill.
My old college horticulture, my college horticulture teacher said a weed is merely a plant in the wrong place. So if you like it, it's a wonderful plant. If you don't like it, it's a weed, depending on who you ask.
Plus, the deer won't eat it.
Yep.
They leave it alone. So that's a good thing.
Absolutely, and it loves the sun, and it freezes down, but it comes back. So, it's good to hear your voice. You get out and enjoy this Sunday, and we'll talk again.
All right, thank you so much.
Thank you, Ann. Goodbye. Let's see. I think we've got time to get another call in here before we take a break, and that would be Scott. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
I'm not sure if this is a you question or a Dr. Kirby question or both. I have a lab that was bit on the nose last week by a 10-inch rattlesnake.
Okay.
Killed another rattlesnake last night. Is there anything to put in the yard to get rid of rattlers?
Well, that's an excellent question, and Dr. Kirby could probably answer it too, but I've dealt with rattlesnakes most of my life, and they don't bother me as long as I see them first. General biology of a rattlesnake, they are creatures that typically den up in the winter months, and the female rattlesnake's probably not going to move more than a mile away, you know, from the den during the season. Male rattlesnakes can move 8 to 10 miles away from the den. So this is a time of year we see snakes moving through. The rattlesnakes you're seeing now are most likely the males, and they were somewhere else yesterday. They'll be somewhere else tomorrow. So as far as having a resident population of rattlesnakes on my ranch, I always found that if I ever let the rats get out of control in the barn, then I'm going to end up with rattlesnakes. And simply by eliminating their common food source, which is most commonly rats and mice, then I would rarely ever see a rattlesnake. But this time of year, you're quite likely to see them moving through if there are any in your area. Now, as a general thing to keep them out of a garden, places like that, if we put out just about anything that has cedar oil in it, it's pretty good repellent, and they don't like it. They don't hang around. There's a more toxic product they call Snake Away, based on the same thing that goes into mothballs, that I'm not really going to tell you is real good for your puppy dogs either. But So that's a long answer to a short question. The snakes that you see are probably not looking to stay around your place. So putting out a repellent might or might not make a move through a little bit more quickly. But the rattlesnakes that you see right now are, for the most part, on their way to somewhere else to spend the winter. So as Dr. Kirby would certainly tell you, it's very important to keep a little bit of the, get give your dog the rattlesnake vaccine on a yearly basis. It's interesting, we were both out of town last Sunday, but the Sunday before we were talking about, anaphylactic shock and things like that, and, obviously that's something you get more from bee stings than you do from snakes, but he was recommending that a little bit of a very mild steroid, I believe he spoke of dexamethasone, or dex as they all call it, he said that's a great thing to keep on hand, and it saves a lot of dogs' lives that have gotten bitten by a big snake, even ones that have been vaccinated. So it wouldn't hurt you, and since you're a country guy, you probably know how to give a shot. But talk to your vet about getting, a syringe of Dex to have on hand when you have a lot of rattlesnakes around. But it's not practical. There's not really anything you can do short of building a snake fence that will guarantee that the rattlers don't show up in the yard occasionally when you live in the country.
All right. Yeah, we keep everything mowed down, and I haven't seen any rats or mice, but you're in a country, you never know what you'll see.
And again, the snakes you're seeing are probably not resident snakes that actually live on your property, unless you measure your property in sections rather than acres. But you're seeing snakes that are moving through, and if you raised extremely expensive dogs or show dogs or something like that, you can put up a dense, almost a hardware cloth barrier, and snake's not going to go over anything that's more than 2 or 3 feet high. You could make your yard snake proof. Is it necessary? Is it worth it? For 99% of us, no.
Okay. Appreciate you.
Always a pleasure. And give that pup a pet for us.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thanks, Scott. I guess now, Craig, let's get a break out of the way. And when we come back, Terry will be up first.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right. Let's get right straight back to the phone lines. And looks like it's going to be Terry and Robert and Dana. Terry's up first. Good morning, Terry.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Well, thank you for calling. Very good.
I live in Corpus, and because of the drought, I've got tiny, tiny little ants all over the place. First, I started seeing them in the pots, but now they seem to be in the yard. Mm-hmm. And they're tiny. They dart all over the place. Are these crazy ants, or how do I get rid of them?
Do they bite?
No.
Do they bite? Okay. Then they could be, golly, there are over 100 species of ants, and everybody I talk to is seeing more and more different kinds of ants than we've ever seen before. Inside your home, you can make a bait for them, just, equal parts, just a teaspoon or so.
They're not inside.
Okay.
They're just outside in my flower pots and in the yard now.
I hope they'll stay there. Then what you need is called spinosad. Spinosad is a natural insecticide. It's a very good ant killer, but it's totally safe for kids and pets and people and everybody else. In fact, it's so safe, there's a special form of it that we give to dogs to prevent fleas. But you can get spinosad, or even better, you can get something called spinosad soap that you can simply spray around the yard. For your flower pots, I would just put some of it in a watering can and, mixed with water, of course, and just water your plants with it. It's not an oil. It's not going to burn or hurt your plants in any way, but it will kill the ants that are down in the soil. And it's spinosad. I'd stay away from anywhere that bees are active or butterflies are active, because it could bother those creatures. But just in the grass, just in your pots and things like that, no, it's perfectly safe. And In this case, in your pots, you're not going to spray it on your plants. You're only going to, you know, pour it in the soil. So even if these were pots, you had something in to attract the monarchs that are migrating through Corpus right now, as a matter of fact, it's not going to bother the things. It's not because you're not going to be spraying it up on the foliage. It's not going to bother your butterflies or bees or anything like that. So I think it'd be a very safe product for you to use. And okay, maybe
usually when I would see ant hills, I would put the diatomaceous earth, and they would disappear. But these ones are, and I know it's because of the drought, because it's been so hot over here and dry and dry.
Yeah, and DE, dry diatomaceous earth, is very effective, but it has to be dry to be effective. And so I'm not going to tell you to put it in your pots, because next time you water, it's not going to work anymore. It's why I think diatomaceous earth is a little better choice. But if you see a mound of them or something like that, DE works because it's an abrasive. It gets down in the ant's joints, and it starts slicing and cutting. And ants don't have a system of blood vessels like we do. Their body juices, so to speak, are in something we call a hemoseal, and it just cuts through that, and they dehydrate and die. So diatomaceous earth is a very effective ant killer, but it would be prohibitive to try to treat your whole yard with it. And like I say, your plants that are in the pots, if it was the only thing I had, I'd actually flip the pot over, slide the plant out, dust the root system real heavily with diatomaceous earth, then put it back in the pot and go as long as I could before I watered, and that would kill the ants. But the spinosad is a very safe product for everybody except the ants.
Okay, I'll try that. Thank you so much for your help. You have a best weekend.
You do the same. And I do. Thank you so much. Goodbye. All right, I believe next in line is going to be Robert. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning, sir. I found out yesterday that the reason my St. Augustine has been dying for the last 3 or 4 months is because I have cinch bugs. I thought I wasn't watering enough. I was doing just like 20 minutes a week along the schedule, and I was just trying to get it through the summer so it could, sprout out in the fall. But come find out, most of it's dead. I'm at least a third, if not a half, of my yard is dead now.
And where are you located?
I'm north of the airport, where all the Stonies are.
Probably don't have chinch bugs. Chinch bugs are very rare in San Antonio. We're seeing a lot of grubworm damage. But anyway, that's beside the point. You've got some dead grass out there. Is it just big dead areas, or is there live green grass here and there through the middle of it?
There's a few little sparse bits that are growing in the dying areas, and then there's just areas that are totally dead. I showed it to a gal at Rainbow Gardens, and she said that, that's cinch bugs. I had a video that I took of the grass. So I don't know. I know I need to do something, and today's my day to do it. I was going to go buy some type of chemical that would kill them, but the problem is I've got 3 things here that I've gotten over the years, and none of them say cinch bugs on it.
Yeah. Well, the best thing you could do for that grass would be to buy some compost. Put 1/2 inch of compost over it, water thoroughly. That's going to help the grass that's there come back to life and start spreading. I hate to doubt somebody else's word, but if you want to know if you have chinch bugs, here's what you do. You take a coffee can or something like that, cut out both ends of it, press it down into the grass, and fill it with water. If you have chinch bugs, you'll see them come floating up to the surface. Most of them have wings, have kind of a little diamond shape to them, but I probably see 100 pieces of grass that are damaged by grubs for every one that I see. Chinch bugs are very common in coastal areas. If you were calling me from Corpus Christi, that's why I ask where you live. If you were calling me from Corpus Christi, I'd say, probably got chinch bugs, and you want to go after them with a spinosad or something like that. And if you want to buy a safe chemical for you and the pets and something that will kill them, spinosad liquid, or there are granular forms you can get, would be what I would choose. But I just don't think it's chinch bugs. If it is, beneficial nematodes are going to be a better choice. They will take care of fire ants. They will take care of fleas. They will take care of any grubs that are out there. But there are virtually no grubs active at this time. Come fall, yeah, we'll start worrying about other things. But if I were going to spend money to try to revive your grass, I'd spend it on compost rather than chemicals.
So, are you saying that you're relatively certain it's not chinch bugs?
I'm saying I'm about 98% certain it's not chinch bugs. But I say if you want to test, do your own test. Get your, you know, get a Folgers coffee can. I'm not a coffee drinker, but there are plenty of coffee drinkers around. But get some can that's, you know, it could be a peaches can, something that's about 4, 5, 6 yeah. inches in diameter. Cut out both ends. Go out and press it down into the grass and fill it with water. Within 2 or 3 minutes, you will see little insects come floating up. They're going to be about 3/16 of an inch long. They're going to have wings. They're going to have kind of a diamond pattern in the middle of the wings. If you can do that and you tell me that you have chinch bugs, yeah, then I'll tell you to get spinosad or something like that. But I hate to see you spend money when I just really don't think that's what you have. But you do your own chinch bug test. That'll tell you. You can find out in 5 minutes whether you've got chinch bugs or not.
Okay. And if it's not, well, regardless of whether it's that or not, you're saying get some compost and spread those.
Yeah, get some good compost. The Nature's Creation makes a good bagged compost. I don't think you're going to get enough to want to get a pickup truck full. And if you shop regularly at Rainbow Gardens, I know they keep Nature's Creation compost there. I've known the people at Rainbow for a lot of years, but not everybody there is experienced as some are, and we'll just leave it at that. But if you want to buy bagged compost, and if you shop regularly at Rainbow, they're going to be a good place for you to go get it.
Okay. Could I ask you one more thing about something totally different?
Of course. Of course.
I have a Monterey oak that I planted in the front yard. I got it Fannix Nursery?
Yeah, Fannix Nursery on the southeast side. Yeah.
Yeah, I got it about 5 years ago and put it in the ground. And I've had a big 4-inch fence around it to keep the deer away from it and keep them from, you know, butting their head against it. You know, that's
right.
Another tree that was here before I moved in.
Yeah.
But anyway, when can I take that down? Because right now it's about maybe 4 or 5 inches in diameter. I mean, it's a good, healthy tree, and it's got lots of acorns on it. I mean, it's my legacy to the park, I guess, is I'll be feeding the deer long after I'm gone.
Well, the definition of a statesman by, I don't know whether it's Thomas Jefferson or Madison or somebody said, is a true man plants a tree under whose shade he knows he will never sit. So planting a tree is always a good thing. But if you've ever watched a buck rub its antlers on trees, a tree, I mean, it's got to have thick, rough bark all over it before it's going to be immune from, you know, from potential deer damage. I will tell you what I do in my own yard in places where I have trees that I want to protect is in the late summer, early fall, time when the bucks usually start rubbing, either marking territory or rubbing velvet off. But let's say you're telling me you've got about a 4-inch caliper tree. I would take 2 or 3 iron T-posts, just metal fence posts. I put them up against the trunk of the tree, and I put a piece of baling wire around the top and around the bottom. The deer do not want to rub on a metal fence post, and then when we get, you know, beyond the rut, I'll take them off. So it's something that I just put on and off. But otherwise, you're going to have to protect that tree till it's 15 inches in diameter to be certain that the deer aren't going to damage it. So that's how I handle the problem. And I tell you, I've seen many a tree killed by deer rubbing on it, horses eating on it. Not going to be so much of a problem with your oak, but if you're fortunate enough to have gumboomelea and things like that, people don't realize how many porcupines we have in the hill country, and they kill huge numbers of trees. So there are lots of things working against us these days to, you know, let little trees become big trees. But you're either going to leave your cage around it for several more years, or you're just going to use a little different method to keep the deer away from it.
I was thinking of minimizing the diameter of it to just mm-hmm. put it around like maybe a foot around the bark or the trunk of the tree.
Oh, that's fine.
They're going to eat the leaves and the acorns that they can reach, which has prevented that. I mean,
they're going to stand up on their hind feet and eat 6 feet up. One of our employees here has a problem. They come up on her front porch and stand up on their feet and eat her hanging basket. So, that's the one thing you're doing. You're protecting the foliage, and they're going to eat on that, but they're not going to kill your tree. Girdling the bark, it will kill the tree. And that's what, if you reduce the diameter of your cage around it, you're going to prevent girdling, which is a good thing. But if you're really trying to protect the foliage and have a cosmetically beautiful tree, the deer are going to work against you on that.
Yeah. Okay.
You could always build a big fence and get some dogs to stay awake at night. if you're talking to somebody that lives outside of Bernie and, you know, deer are out there all the time. It's just something we put up with. But again, until it gets a real hard, rough bark, you're always in danger of having them girdle. And if you're worried more about eating the foliage, not much to do except build a cage around them.
All right. Thank you very much, sir.
My pleasure. Thank you for the call this morning. Greg, let's get our last break of the show done, and then we'll be back and start with Dana.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. By the way, we're just a little over 10 minutes away from Dr. Kirby's show, and so far as I know, he'll be sitting right here beside me when 11 o'clock rolls around. So be thinking about your questions about your pet's health, which is what we always do on Sundays from 11 till noon here on KTSA Radio. Got time for a few more phone calls, though. It's going to be Dana and John and Shirley. Dana is up first. Good morning, Dana.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I would like to get your advice on how to get some perennials through the winter that I'm having to dig right now. The new planting bed won't be ready until probably January, February.
Okay.
And I'd rather not overwinter them in the garage. So I was wondering about just heeling them in like against the south wall of our house where it would be mm-hmm. kind of warm. And how would that be for getting them through?
I tell you what, you can tell you've been gardening for a while if you know the term healing them in. tell me what kind of perennials we're talking about.
Well, I've got some coneflower, some white vein pipe vine, rain lilies, some clematis. That's
okay.
Probably about it.
Yeah, healing them in would probably do. If we were talking, you know, softer plants like some of the salvias that typically freeze down, I wouldn't recommend it as highly there. But you're talking some hardy perennials, so yeah, healing in is probably going to be. Will get us through a typical winter. I never say normal, but if it should turn off bitterly cold, you can always put a little row cover, a little insulator, something like that over them. So yeah, healing them in should be fine. Heal them in using compost. Old days we would use hay or sawdust or whatever, but nowadays just good manure compost is probably the best thing to heal them in with.
Yeah. Oh, and I forgot to tell you, I'm in zone 7A. I'm in north central Arkansas.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah,
I think all the same. I'm just going to use a little bit more mulch over them. And I would be sure that they're not where they're going to get a lot of rainfall from the roof. If you don't have guttering there, then I'd be out there just mulching up leaves, running your mower through them, and just literally cover them, except for the very tops of them. What we've seen done at the Atlanta Botanical Garden, which is a little more comparable in temperature to you, they'll take fence wire. just cheap old fence wire and build it in and, you know, bend it into about an 18-inch diameter silo. They put this down over their perennials and just fill it up with leaves. And that's how they get things in the ground through the winter. So, I mean, if you're in an area that you could just basically, you don't want anything that's so heavy. That's why I'm backing off the compost now. You don't want anything so heavy that's going to hold moisture for a long period of time. But as you know, air is the best insulator in the world. So, you know, heal them in and then cover them up with whatever you can, and should get through. Even in Arkansas, you should get through the winter without any problem.
Okay. Now, do I need to have them in pots, or would they just be bare rooted down into the whatever I'm covering them with?
Well, it actually probably would be better out of the pots. Hopefully not truly bare rooted, but you know, you can pop them out of the pot. They're not going to grow a lot of roots through the winter months, so it's not like you're going to have a lot of trouble, you know, getting them back up in the spring. But I probably would slip them out of the pots just because it'll be a little bit easier to keep them properly watered. And I think there's some negatives and not many positives to leaving them in the pots for what you're proposing to do.
Yeah. Okay. So to make sure I understand, I don't want to mound dirt up around them, more no. like loose compost than leaves.
Yeah, leaf mold or something around. Like that.
Yeah. Okay. That sounds good. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Bob. I appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate the call. I have to tell you, you're not my most long-distance caller. I had a lady in the nursery yesterday that tells me she listens to me Saturday and Sunday in the nation of Greece every weekend. Okay. So Arkansas is a little bit closer to home, but I'm glad to hear your voice and wish you the best on that day. And keep me posted on how things do. And let's talk to John. Good morning, John.
Good morning, sir. My question is a very simple question, but I've got a type of weed that I used to have a home on the south side, so
uh-huh.
Now I moved to the northeast.
Okay.
But there's a weed, it's like a very green weed. It resembles grass, but it's not grass. It's thicker than grass, and it grows horizontally.
Yeah, probably what we call centipede grass or something like that. What is your basic lawn grass?
It's
St. Augustine or Bermuda or what?
It's St. Augustine, but that one, I noticed a neighbor's yard, you know, has a lot of it, and it's slowly coming my way. And
yeah.
Right now, it's growing a small flower. It's like maybe a quarter of an inch white petals,
yeah.
With yellow in the center.
Right. And it's your St. Augustine, if you keep your St. Augustine healthy, is strong enough to choke it out. Now,
okay.
The problem is the things that kill this weedy invader would also be hard on your permanent grass. So there's not really something I can tell you to spray on that'll kill it without hurting the other. But St. Augustine is our toughest, hardiest grass. It's had a hard, hard summer. But now that the weather is more moderate, now that it looks like we may get some good rainfall, healthy St. Augustine will choke that out completely. So that's what I'm going to tell you to do. Fertilize, put a little bit of compost over the area, especially on the side of the yard where this stuff seems to be invading from, and chances are you'll stop it completely. If you do get some of it started, then we can talk about using orange oil and vinegar or something like that to kill it back, but don't want to do that because that would set your grass back too. But for now, do your fall fertilizing, put about half an inch of compost over the area, and I don't think it's going to come into your yard.
Okay. And so is there like a website to go to find out what type of weed this is?
It's hard. It's just like Texas grasses. The book on there is about 1,200 pages thick.
Wow.
You can try, but most of the websites are written for other parts of the country. Go to dirtdoctor.com. Howard does have a section on weeds in there, and that would be your best chance of identifying it. It's at dirtdoctor.com.
Right. Okay, great. And you are correct, right? I have noticed when it was raining quite a lot that, it would just choke it out to where maybe you would see one here and there, but not
yeah. Well, hopefully we're going to get back to good rain again. John, I'm going to let you go so I can get Shirley in here before the show's over. Shirley, quickly, how can I help you?
About 50 years ago, my brother-in-law gave me some of the old-fashioned type amaryllis.
Uh-huh.
And I had one bulb left that I planted. It has multiplied. When do I dig it and divide it?
Now is probably as good a time of year as there is. Your amaryllis, this is probably what they call American amaryllis. They tend to stop growing. They get kind of dormant toward the end of the summer. And this is the safest and best time to dig them, divide them, and replant them. I would mulch them with some kind of loose mulch this winter just because they're going to be a little bit more tender, having been shocked a little bit by digging and dividing. But I would do it in the next 2 weeks if you possibly can.
Okay, sounds good.
And if you want to, well, I appreciate that. If you decide to put a few of them in pots, you can do that and grow them through the winter that way, and then, you know, plant them in even more areas around your yard. If you want to look it up, that is probably called Amaryllis Johnsoni, like Johnson with two eyes on the end of it. You can read all about it. You're a lucky lady to have them in your yard. They're something we don't see very often, and it's a beautiful plant. So I appreciate the call. Well, everybody else, get out and garden.
Question.
5 seconds.
One quick question.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Suckers off of oak trees. It's now the time to cut them off.
You can cut them anytime. You don't hurt a thing, and don't worry about just mow them off if you can. But now, if it's up in the tree, be sure and use pruning paint. This is KTSA Radio.